I'd like now to welcome Dr. Deborah Cohen. She's author of the new book, A Big Fat Crisis, The Hidden Forces Behind the Obesity Epidemic and How We Can End It. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thanks for having me.
So how big a problem is obesity in the United States today, and how has it grown over the last 50 years or so?
Well, I would say that obesity is the public health crisis of our time. 2 out of 3 Americans are either overweight or obese. 1 out of 3 children. And obesity is a risk factor for an early death. It's a risk factor for heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, and cancer. And so it's costing our nation a lot, about $150 billion more every year in healthcare costs.
$115 billion every year, that's a lot of money, and that adds up really fast.
Yes, it's some people point to obesity as the main reason that our health care costs are rising. And so it's really time that we do something about it. And I also wrote this book to change the way we look at obesity. We have to change the conversation and stop looking at it as an indication of an individual failure or a weakness or a personal choice, because as long as we do that, nothing is going to change. We have to realize that most people are trying very hard to control their weight, but they're being set up to fail. And so we really need to look at what are those forces that are outside of people that are triggering people to eat too much.
Now, let's look at it in a kind of world context. Why are so many more Americans obese than other nations? Why this precipitous increase in obesity?
Well, I think the problem is squarely because of the food industry and their aggressive marketing strategies. They've been studying ways to, you know, increase profits, of course, as most businesses do. But the problem is that when they get people to buy more food, they eat more food, and that has negative consequences for our health. And so the kinds of strategies they realized that work have to do with things that most people can't really recognize or defend themselves against. So, for example, in the 70s, there was a lot of research about the in-store marketing strategies in supermarkets, and they found that just putting items on the ends of aisles or at the cash register or increasing shelf space, all of those things resulted in people buying more, spending more money. And it's something that we don't really recognize. So they've figured out how to encourage our impulsive buying behaviors.
One thing that I found absolutely stunning and sort of horrifying in your book was that supermarkets actually make more money selling shelf space than they do selling food.
Yeah, that's actually been described in a book by Herb Sorensen called Inside the Mind of the Shopper. And it's really amazing, you know, what just the way they arrange foods, promote foods, display things, influences what we buy. There's an area of science called behavioral economics that really show that people can be easily manipulated just by the way information is presented, the order in which it's presented, how it's compared to other things, if it's shown, you know, whether it's a gain or a loss. Like, you know, if we say something's half empty, we'll make one choice. If we say it's half full, we make a different choice. So people are really vulnerable to this kind of presentation.
What is the typical American diet at this point in history? And again, how has it changed since our parents' generation?
Well, basically, our diet has not improved, even though we have a lot more understanding of what is it that makes a healthy diet. The main thing is that people are eating too many calories. We're eating over 500 more calories per day now than we did, you know, 30 years ago. We're eating too many refined grains, too many processed foods, too much meat, and we really need to cut back if we want to control our weight and avoid chronic diseases.
Now, you write in the book about how, first of all, self-control, although we like to think about personal responsibility, and there's something to be said for personal responsibility, but self-control is not really the way we're going to get over the obesity crisis. Why is that?
Well, there are several reasons why people are eating too much when there's too much food available. One is that eating is really an automatic behavior. So that means, like, if we start eating, we don't have to pay attention to what we're doing. We can do other things at the same time. We can multitask. And, you know, eating will occur, you know, whether or not we're directing our hand to pick up our fork and scoop up some food and lift it to our mouth and tell our, you know, teeth to start chewing. You know, we do that without any attention, without any conscious awareness. And so, you know, that's really how we're designed, so that we could presumably eat and look around if there was some threat coming, some enemy that, you know, we could pay attention to other things without, you know, putting ourselves at risk. So that's one thing. The other thing is that self-control is limited. It fatigues like a muscle. So if we spend a lot of time controlling ourselves, a lot of energy, you know, it wears out, and we need to take a rest and take a break. And then when it wears down, we revert to what's considered this automatic, quick thinking, where we basically are working on automatic pilot, or, you know, we're acting reflexively, and we don't actively control what we're doing. So everyone faces that. We all have limits to self-control.
And as you point out, people who are stressed have a lot more trouble doing impulse control when it comes to food.
Well, it's probably not just food. It's any decision that people have trouble with after they've been stressed a lot. So, you know, the problem is that they're part of our brain that's responsible for this thoughtful cognitive processing is very small in comparison to the parts of our brain that really handle all of what we need to do automatically. And, you know, when we're overwhelmed, when, you know, we've already occupied that space with something else, the automatic part of our brain takes over. And really, that's what's controlling us most of the time.
Now, are some people more susceptible to gaining weight than others? I mean, it seems like there are so many different body types.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a huge variation among people. But that level of variation has not changed over the past 20 to 30 years when the obesity rates have doubled. So there's always a spectrum. You know, we always look at all kinds of human behaviors and outcomes at the idea of the bell curve, right, where most of us are average, then there are some people less than average, some people below average. And what's happened is that there's been a shift. So everybody across the spectrum has been moving up and gaining weight. So the average person is gaining 1 to 2 pounds a year.
And again, that adds up over a couple of decades.
Right, and that's why, on average, Americans are 20 pounds heavier than they were 20 to 30 years ago.
We're talking to Deborah Cohen about her book, A Big Fat Crisis, The Hidden Forces Behind the Obesity Epidemic and How We Can End It. A poor diet is, among other things, I mean, it's certainly a result of aggressive marketing on the part of the food industry, and then that marketing results in bad habits on our part as consumers, as eaters. Why can't healthy eating, for example, a balanced diet of fresh, nutritious food, vegetables and fruits and so on, why can't that become a habit? I mean, if you do something for a while, then it becomes a habit and self-control no longer plays a role. And I say this because that's actually my own personal experience of changing eating habits. You just make different habits.
Well, absolutely. Some people can do that. But the problem is, if you look around, you know, most people are not doing that. And there are many people who have tried to change their habits and control their weight, but they can't seem to do it. The problem is that a lot of people are sensitive to cues in their environment that they may not even recognize are there. So, for example, when people watch TV, there may be some ads, you know, about food or candy or sodas. And that often, just seeing that food, that advertisement, will make people feel hungry. And they may not recognize that it was triggered by the ad. They might start feeling this hungry and this hunger and think that it comes inside of them. And the next thing you know, they're walking to the refrigerator to get something to eat. you know, the same thing when you go out, you know, passing stores, you smell freshly baked cookies. Those kinds of things trigger your feelings of hunger, and many people can't tell the difference between these external cues and their internal cues. So that's one thing. The other thing is if anyone ever goes out to eat in a restaurant, it's very hard to get food that won't increase your risk of a chronic disease. So if you go to a restaurant and they serve you, you know, twice as much as you really need to maintain your weight, you're probably going to end up eating more than you should. And that is so common and is such a huge problem in our country. It's pretty clear that people who eat out more are have a much higher risk of being overweight or obese than people who eat out less.
With respect to the issue of TV advertising, when people gain media literacy tools that help them understand how it is that food advertising works, do they become less susceptible to it?
You know, you would think that it would make a difference, but in point of fact, it rarely does make a difference because the kinds of reactions we have to images and, you know, all kinds of stimuli around us are reflexive. So we tend to really not be able to interrupt those reflexive responses. Especially, you know, like I said, if that cognitive part of our brain that has that capacity to do it is occupied or busy with something else. You know, we live in this information age where we're constantly bombarded with all kinds of information and stimuli and choices, and all of that is very overwhelming to people. And as a result, you know, where we can act automatically, we often do more than we might have in the past.
Now, you don't talk about this so much in your book, but I couldn't help but wondering about cultures in which food preparation is an art, like France and Italy, where there's a culture of food that really is as great as their cultures of painting and sculpture, in the face of which factory food is disgusting. And a lot fewer people there are fat, and I suspect the ones that are becoming obese are the ones who've been exposed to U.S.-style advertising and junk food. But what about the idea of promoting, as the slow food movement does, for example, as farmers markets do, a whole different way of life and thinking about eating?
Well, I think that would certainly be helpful. You know, I think the reason people in France are less likely to be overweight than Americans is because they snack less. They don't have, you know, eat in between meals. The portion sizes are generally smaller, and a lot of the supermarkets and grocery stores actually close in the evening, so they don't really have an opportunity to engage in impulsive eating. If the food isn't available, you have to plan, and if you plan, you're more likely to use that part of your brain that is wiser, you know, and able to make better decisions. So it's the environment. It's the total environment. It's not just one thing that contributes to, you know, exactly what people are eating.
Now, what is the connection between obesity and poverty?
Well, we know that in America, people with a lower income have higher rates of obesity than those with a higher income. But what's interesting about that, if you look at the change in obesity rates across this spectrum over time, there's been almost an equal increase in the higher educated groups as in the lower educated groups or the higher income groups. Everyone's increased, although the disparities between the groups remains.
Out of curiosity, what are the eating habits like of physicians? In your book, you talk about how much the campus has changed where you went to medical school, and there used to be a few little stores and restaurants, and now there are gazillions of them. But off and on, sort of anecdotally, I've heard kind of scary stories about how particularly the training years of medical school make it almost impossible to sit down and eat leisurely healthy meals.
Yeah, definitely it's a problem when you're rushed and you have to get food in a hurry or you're, you know, occupied all day, maybe in surgery or, you know, in clinics, you don't have time to get a bite. Yeah, it's true that people may just grab a snack which is loaded with, you know, salt, sugar, and fats. absolutely, that's a problem. And it's exacerbated because we put those foods everywhere you go. You know, it's at every cash register, vending machines on every floor of every office building or hospital. I mean, it's ridiculous that a hospital is selling junk food at all in their premises, but that's really the standard everywhere.
Now, you recommend solutions to the obesity epidemic that involve regulation, and some of the ideas are based on the successful interventions involving alcohol and tobacco. What are some examples of that?
Well, I think one of the first things we could do that I think is actually reasonable and plausible and feasible is to establish standardized portion sizes so that when people go out to eat, they're not given too much food when they didn't ask for it. So, you know, the idea is to put people in charge of how much they're being served instead of letting restaurants automatically serve them food that, you know, will end up increasing their risk of chronic diseases. So, for example, if we're, you know, ordering a combo meal, that meal should not have more than 700 calories. If we're ordering, you know, pieces a la carte, you know, a serving of meat should be 3 ounces. A serving of vegetables should be a whole cup. You know, a serving of fruit should be either half a cup or a whole cup, depending on the fruit. But those standards, those portion standards, have already been established by the USDA, and then there's another set of standards that the FDA has used, so that together, you know, it should really cover every possible food that's being sold. Now, having a standard portion size doesn't prohibit people from ordering as much as they want. You know, they can order 2 portions, 3 portions, as much as they want. But what it does is that it gives transparency. And people know what they're getting. Right now, it's almost impossible to figure out what you're getting. Even when calories are listed, you don't know, are you getting, you know, a full portion of vegetables or fruit or, you know, whole grains. So most people would then be able to rely that one portion is enough for them. And that really, I think, would make a big dent in and help people who want to control their weight.
And something similar has actually been done for servings of wine, beer, and other kinds of alcohol.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a standard drink of beer is 12 ounces, wine, 5 ounces, a shot of liquor, 1.5 ounces. And that's because those quantities typically contain about 0.6 ounces of pure ethanol. And if anyone, you know, gets their driver's license renewed or, you know, goes to the DMV, they can use those quantifications to figure out what's their risk of driving drunk. So they know if, you know, a woman who weighs so much and drinks so much alcohol, they'll know that they have to wait 1 hour or 2 hours before they should get in the car and drive. And so that helps people gauge, you know, what their risks are. And we absolutely need something like that for food.
Now, is junk food addictive in the same way that alcohol and tobacco are addictive?
Well, you know, our brains have a system of giving us sort of rewards and pleasure. There are these neurohormones. Dopamine is really one of the important ones. So that anything that we need to do for our survival, we actually get pleasure from it. So eating triggers our pleasure centers. And if we didn't enjoy eating, we would probably not survive as a species. So, yes, we use the same pathways to reinforce and give us pleasure from eating as are involved in the drugs of abuse, you know, heroin, cocaine, also alcohol. All of those pathways apply to food as well.
When that whole controversy about limiting the size of soft drinks that could be sold in New York was current, there was a lot written about something that maybe you can explain to us in more detail, but basically human beings evolved to crave sugar because sugar is relatively rare in nature. We can get it like in the form of honey or fruits or whatever, store it and use it. But when it's abundant, we still crave it, but we can't store it because we're eating way too much of it. So it's basically we're following our natural cravings for how we evolve, but the environment is just so radically different.
Yeah, well, the fact is sugar is easy to absorb, and it gives us a very quick energy boost. So when we do have too much sugar, we do store it as fat, you know, for use at a later time. But absolutely, we get this immediate pleasure. It's absorbed very quickly, and we need sugar to feed ourselves and to, you know, stay alive. So, you know, the problem with the Bloomberg rule to suggest, well, we cap soda beverages at 16 ounces was really because they focused on this one item, you know, soda, when in fact many types of food contribute to overweight and obesity. And then they also had the difficulty that administratively they don't regulate convenience stores. Only the state regulates convenience stores in New York City. And so it seemed like there was an exception for places like that were selling the Big Gulp, which was, you know, the most egregious, selling, you know, 32, 44, or 50-plus ounces of soda as a single serving. So they had trouble getting through the courts on those grounds that they, you know, somehow it seemed arbitrary that they singled out soda and then they only were regulating it in a limited number of outlets. But I think what I'm proposing would overcome some of those objections because it's not just a single item. It would cover all foods. And hopefully it would cover all retail establishments where food is sold prepared.
Including supermarkets.
Wherever they're selling, well, it wouldn't be for packaged items, you know, where you do need to get several servings, you know, like a pound of flour. You know, you can't have a single serving of flour that you're using to prepare other foods. But, you know, when food is sold ready to eat, that they should be available in single portions.
So there's a big problem which is kind of at the center of this, and you started to talk about it at the beginning of our conversation, which is that we are getting so much pressure from the food industry, which is essentially a factory, industrial, agribusiness industry that is primarily responsible to its shareholders, not to its consumers. It works on a growth model. We're getting pressure from them through advertising and marketing to eat the stuff that they want us to eat, as opposed to the previous model, which we've had pretty much throughout all of history, which is our food comes from independent farmers who, in theory and for much of the history of the planet in practice, have been able to make a living in a sustainable manner without growth.
It's a problem because we are not looking at the consequences of this new, you know, agribusiness. But I think government really has a role to play here to protect citizens who are unable to achieve their health goals because of all of these, you know, triggers and stimuli and marketing strategies. And so it is time for government to step in because people cannot fight this on their own. You know, as individuals, each of us fighting this big, you know, behemoth is just not working. It's obvious it's not working. You know, we've recognized this problem for quite some time, and it's, you know, not getting better whatsoever. And so just these few things that I'm recommending, you know, the first one I said was portion sizes, but the second one are these restrictions on impulse marketing strategies. So my idea is, okay, let's take the candy away from the cash register, not to put it in people's faces where they're exposed and confronted and have to resist. You know, we can't ignore food. We're automatically wired to pay attention to it. And so to get the most egregious, you know, high-risk processed foods away, you know, from our, you know, visions all the time, you know, that could make a big difference for many people who do want to avoid that, but then once they see it, they just, you know, feel like, oh, they give in because, you know, they're overwhelmed and they're on this automatic pilot. And so, you know, many other countries don't have candy at the cash register. And if they're able to make a living, you know, with stores, we should be able to manage that way too.
I wonder if there isn't also a role for, I guess, for lack of a better word, mindfulness. And again, I say this because when I was a little kid, I loved Pop-Tarts, Well, some years ago, I thought, oh, comfort food. Let me buy a Pop-Tart. I ate it. It was gross. It doesn't taste good. It makes you feel sick to your stomach. And, I mean, obviously, eating is an automatic process that we do. But if you start to actually pay attention to what you're putting in your mouth and how it makes you feel, you really notice things that you don't notice when you're just doing it watching TV or driving or on automatic pilot.
Well, I absolutely agree. It's really helpful for individuals to be mindful, but that's really not public policy. That's not how it works. You know, we don't take that attitude when it comes to car safety or building safety. We don't tell people, well, you know, just be a better driver. You know, we're not going to fix this pothole in the road. Just drive a little more slowly, go around it, pay attention. You know, those are types of things that we feel that government can help people with so that they don't have to always be so mindful. You know, people are human. We are prone to error. We do make mistakes, and we can anticipate when we will make, you know, bad judgment. And so it's really up to government and the modern society that cares about its citizens to make an effort to point these pitfalls out and to make arrangements so that we don't, you know, have problems. We have to make it harder for people to make bad choices than easy. Right now, to make a good choice is very, very difficult. To make the bad choice, that's the easy thing. We need to switch that calculus around.
Dr. Deborah Cohen is author of the new book, A Big Fat Crisis, The Hidden Forces Behind the Obesity Epidemic and How We Can End It. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's been a pleasure.